Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Authors Access, where authors get published and published authors get successful. I'm Tyler Tischler, Associate Editor with Reader Views Incorporated.
And I'm Victor Volkman from Loving Healing Press in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It's September 20th, 2007, and welcome to episode number 42 in our series. Tonight's topic is Writing for Social Change, and our special guest who will be joining us this hour is Anya Ochtenberg, and you can learn more about our guest on the Authors Access website, which is authorsaccess.com. Now, Anya Ochtenberg is an award-winning fiction writer as well as a poet, and her recently completed novel, More Than the Wind, was excerpted in Harvard Review, and her novella, Stories of Devil Girl, has been released on CD. Her second book of poetry, The Stone of Language, was published in 2004 by West End Press out of Albuquerque after being a finalist in 5 poetry competitions. Her stories have received awards from Francis Ford Coppola, the Asheville Fiction Writers Workshop, Raymond Carver, and many others. Her first book of poetry, I Know What the Small Girl Knew, was published by Holy Cow Press out of Minnesota. She is at work on a novel centering in the experience of a Cambodian woman born of an African-American father at the very moment of the bombing of Cambodia by U.S. forces. Now, she has taught creative writing widely, including New York University School of Visual Arts, Springfield College, Boston, Hamline University, University of Minnesota, University of New Mexico, and also at summer writing workshops for organizations such as the Women's Writing Guild and many other great public events. She currently teaches writers' workshops and classes throughout the country on deepening characterization, essential story elements, autobiography, and autobiographical fiction. And she's the founder and author of Writing for Social Change, Redream a Just World, a series of multi-genre workshops on how to write for social change. She also offers manuscript consultation for fiction writers, poets, essayists, and memoir writers. Private clients include people all over the world and in many different genres. Good evening to you, Anya.
Hello. Nice to be somewhere out of the rain, which it's doing outside.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Anya.
Thank you.
I wanted to start out tonight by talking to you a little bit about the different kinds of writers' workshops and classes that you do. And I understand that they're divided up into 3 sections.
Yes.
And so can you give us an idea of the 3 sections of your workshop and your book in progress and how they work to reframe our ideas about writing?
Yes, thank you. The first section is called Redream a Just World, and that's sort of that came out of a novel a Nigerian writer, Ben Okri, wrote called The Famished Road, and there's some talk in there about the central character's father redreaming the world as he slept. And I guess that the first part of the workshop really looks at a kind of gathering more tools to really open up language in a way that isn't always looked at. For instance, there's a lot of look at in that first section on about association, and association is certainly at the heart of poetry, but it's also a very political kind of tool, finding the connections between things that seem not to always be connected is something that we do when we, for instance, look at a piece of chocolate or a cup of coffee and say, well, where did this really come from, and at what cost, and let me really know the story of this, know the way that this thing has traveled through the globe and how it came to me, and so that we need to sort of open up these stories and keep, you know, finding the connections between things. So is there a connection between me sitting in a coffee shop and someone's life in Central America or in Africa? And so it's certainly a political act to see connection, and it's very much a poetic act. Of course, when you look at something like Pablo Neruda's odes, and he sort of is kind of looking at each object, the elemental odes, and he looks at each object to get its fuller story and to associate from, you know, these socks or that container of salt into the sort of fullness of the truth of that object. So in the first one, We Dream a Just World, there's a lot of work that we do to kind of introduce various ideas, the idea, for instance, of juxtaposition, of how one thing next to another tells a story, even if they seem not to be related. And there's a sort of amazing little excerpt that I use from the abolitionist sisters, Sarah and I believe it's Angela Grimke, and there's a kind of description of a beautiful sort of living room. There's the hearth, there's the mom doing her embroidery and the happy children playing quietly, and the dad with his pipe sitting in a rocking chair, and then at the hearth there's a slave who's bleeding from the mouth from the sort of bit that's put in her mouth, and this sort of absolute outrageous world next to another world becomes obvious in that. But that when we look at how one thing's juxtaposed next to the other, like in a book like House of Sand and Fog, a huge amount comes forward from saying, well, what's next to what? And how does this story or how does the poem come from looking at what's next to, you know, something else? So there's a lot of basic tools in the Redream a Just World part of the workshop. In Place and Exile, Borders and Crossings, there's part of it does a kind of, you know, sort of turning over of the idea that we all write from a sense of place. And for many of us, that would be nice, but we come from immigrants and refugees. There are people in flight at this moment all over the globe, people running for jobs, running from wars, having to move because of gentrification. There are people who are homeless. And so what does it then mean in this, you know, this world that's turning around to write from a sense of place? So some of that is reframed, and also I look at sort of to write any book about any characters, whether fictional or nonfictional. To write a poem, as Neruda does, about his pair of socks or the salt shaker, means entering another world in a sense, means crossing a border in some way between you and that other person or you and that thing. And so we do a lot of work that crosses borders, in effect, to develop characters, to understand the full development of another world. And then briefly, the last workshop, which is called Yearning and Justice, Writing the Unlived Life, kind of takes the idea of the backstory, which we know we must have, what did a character do before it got to a certain moment, and says, well, it's not just what the character lived that's important, it's also what the character did not live, what the character missed, what the character yearns for and could never attain, that I think makes for sensitive and full portraits. And that, of course, is something that's very deeply political as well, not just what's the backstory, the usual, what happened before, but what did not happen and what happened in, what was someone thwarted from doing? What are someone's frustrations? What is the life one did not get to live? So it kind of shifts a lot of the ideas that we have about what we write and how we write. And there's a lot of work with language and the very structure of language to open it, to make it new, to make it fully alive. And to take ideas about writing and sort of put them back into a larger context so that we understand them more fully and don't just get them as a kind of set of rules out of a textbook.
I can definitely see where you're talking about being a very much a political thing, but even beyond that, it sounds to me like it's really about awareness and just being aware of, like you were saying, where does the coffee come from or where does the chocolate come from, and really understanding the connection between all of us. It sounds to me like a real bringing together of people and realizing what a global or, you know, what a small world we live in, that our, we really have a global economy.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you next, how did you come to being interested in this kind of writing, and what really made it important for you when you began?
I guess that I understood, I always sort of understood writing as being a little subversive, that when I grew up in city housing projects, and, you know, if you said anything you out of line or anything that was a little different, someone would say, "Who do you think you are? Shut up," you know, kind of, you know, you were kind of silenced, in part because people were exhausted, in part because people were afraid, and so I sort of understood, and I was very afraid in my classrooms, and I kind of did my writing under the table. So I did that sort of, you know, here's my paragraphs and my topic sentences, and here I'm doing what the teacher tells me on top of the desk. And then my writing was really that something was happening to me under the desk. And so I always understood writing as in some way pulling away or commenting on or looking deeper than what was happening sort of on top of the desk in a way. And I guess there were many ways that I felt that I was silenced. I left home very early. I worked very hard, and then I couldn't get work. I was homeless. I was sort of a cipher of sorts in the world. I was certainly discounted. I was certainly made invisible. And I guess I certainly have never forgotten what that feels like. And also looked around. I mean, I really understood that my story was one of many, that there was always a story next to my story. And other people's lives became more and more important to me in terms of how they were discounted. And I guess that when I started teaching as well, I sort of got huge evidence that it was in ways many different kinds of people who felt and were silenced and were discounted in some way, including some people who I would have looked at as very privileged, and yet there was something deep within them that they felt they could not express because they were somehow socially, you know, herded into being one way or another. And so I understood by its very nature that writing had to do with an extraordinary act of freedom, both for self and of in some way connecting to the lives of others and making more of a space for them as well, whether in the act of your own writing, your own speaking out, your teaching in some way. And so I guess when I remember organizing a reading of 25, quote, dropouts in New York who were students at a wonderful school that got defunded called the Young Adult Learning Academy. And there were about 130 people in the audience, and it was just so extraordinary. And there were kids who were so brilliant and lovely and brutalized and had it hard. And one young woman at the end came up and said, "You know, no matter what else ever happens to me, I will always have this and I will always be proud of this." And it just reinforced for me what I've seen again and again in so many different kinds of groups and classrooms and within my own heart, that there's something about this power of language and of sharing one's truest voice, whether it's in fiction or poetry or however it is, there's something extraordinary that frees oneself and makes a place for oneself in language and you know, and in your world. So it just became just absolutely central for me, both for my own, the constant need to free my own heart, and also as a wonderful thing to do with other people, and I realize a very powerful political act as well.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you about all of that. I love when you said that writing is subversive. I mean, it really truly is, and people don't understand people when they want to first start writing out or when they first want to start writing. It's always, I think, difficult for a writer to announce that they want to write and that they think their story is worth telling.
Mm-hmm.
And I was struck, I was looking at your website, and I was struck about, in the workshops, one of the things that you said was, among other things, we will examine issues of memory, how we reframe a story with each telling, working to discover its meaning and power to heal on both the personal and communal levels. And so I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about why you think we reframe our stories and why it's important to understand that we do that, and maybe how that empowers us by reframing the story.
Yeah. I think it's a very interesting question, because I think that the part of what happens when we write is that we have a place to stand, in a sense, and look at our lives. So we're so often caught up for so many reasons in the living, in getting through, and maybe sometimes in this story as it's been handed to us, family saying, look, you're not worth much, or look, you can only go this far, or look, this is what your parents did for you, or whatever it is. And part of the thing of writing, when one writes one's own story, or when one writes characters that in some way may look very different from you but are connected by some extraordinary, silk line from gut to gut, you have a bit of a critical distance. You have a place to look back. And what pushes forward in the telling of your story is kind of the meaning of your life, in a way, is kind of this your central, your deepest and most central intentions in living. You start to see your life as the making of meaning. And so when you work, for instance, as I have with so many different kinds of people who have found life rough, and that's all kinds of people, it's something I've come to realize, not just the kids like me who grew up in the projects, but you find the sort of central meaning and power of your life pushing forward, and you look back at it, and in making it, in a sense, art, in finding, the threads that really run through everything, and finding the way certain things are present all the time, you start to understand the very structure of your living. And I think that is both healing, it's transformative, and it's deeply freeing and deeply political, and also gives you the stuff that makes the story, makes it into something potent and beautiful, makes it art.
Wow, that is really eloquent. Thank you for that. I've got a question, and I hope I don't sound like a simpleton, but I mean, given that we're often dealing with issues of human rights and so on, how do I avoid writing a screed or a manifesto and create something that's really palatable? Is there a way that I can just get my frustrations out first so that the story is allowed to come through, or how does that work?
Well, I think one thing I've loved doing in these courses is gathering sort of the most wonderful, powerful, beautiful, and there's more coming every day, but gathering things that are not manifestos or political tracts or dogmatic, but things that just take language and shake it inside out. And I think that there's so many examples of this wonderful stuff that's deeply political. And I think on the one hand, the question is, what's at stake for someone, and what does someone care about? And, I mean, I used to write things that I guess people classified as political, and I didn't understand that until I started to look around. I said, I'm just writing about what I care about. And then I came to understand that for many people, or for some people, it felt, and this was, somewhat in the old days, it felt more separate than I think it does now, because I think now we have access daily to terrible images, terrible facts, and to numbers and statistics and predictions that make us question our very existence on the earth, on the planet. So I think where more of us are getting that it's that there's not such a separation between the personal and the political, and that when we write about what moves us, what we care about, when we connect from gut to gut, it becomes powerful. I mean, I used to work with people and get them to work with their own experiences of exclusion and then connect that in a way, have them begin to see what someone might go through who is excluded on the basis of gender or because they're homeless or because of their color or their culture. There's just such, for instance, wonderful tools. There's a writer named Aimé Césaire who is from Martinique, and he was a discovery of André Breton, the surrealist in Paris, but then he was going home, and he was going home to his poor, poor colonized island, many, I guess, in the 50s. And before he did, he wrote, he thought about his island, he thought about the poverty of the people, and he wrote something called Notebooks on a Return to My Native Land. And there's a little section in it where he says, I want to rediscover the secret of great speech and of great burning. I want to say leaf. I want to say tree. I used to know the whole thing because I loved it so much. But in other words, the things that powerfully affect us, whether they're personal or whether they're in the family next door or whether they're in Africa or Latin America, whatever they are, the things that powerfully affect us are the things that rip, in a sense, the veneer off language and that push us to discover our own sort of voice and the forms that we need to use to really speak. And that's what I think. I think it's easy enough to stay away from the manifesto.
Yeah, I guess, you know, what popped up while you were saying that is the old touchstone, write what you know.
I used to feel, because I grew up in the projects, that and I grew up in a very small and very frightened sort of kind of situation and culture in a way. And so I used to feel, well, that's not fair. Writing what I know is not fair, because it made me feel ghettoized further, in the sense it made me feel like, well, I can only write something dreary and I can only write something this way or that way. And so I would defy everything, and then I would write, I would use language like, I could barely understand it. I just throw it to the wind and allow this desire to be beyond what I knew to move me, I think. And in a way, that connected me to other peoples and to other cultures. But I think that where that is somehow achingly true, it doesn't always look that way. But for instance, if you're a fiction writer or you're writing someone's story that's a nonfiction story, but you're connecting from some powerful experience. I mean, when Kafka wrote about Gregor Samsa being waking up as a cockroach, it wasn't because Kafka, you know, was a bug, but indeed he might have felt like one in terms of how he was treated. And so, you know, what we know is so profound and is so enormous and is so much more than our sort of our street or our, you know, our statistical information, which is usually pretty incorrect anyway. Check this box. So it's a fine, it's write what you know, but in the deepest sense. It's like when you write a character's voice, it's not just a mimicking of a character. You want to write the soul of that character. And they may not sound exactly the way they might have sounded in real life at that address, but you bring forward, in a sense, the soul of the character.
Yeah, I get that. I get that completely. Thanks for elaborating that. And Tyler, over to you.
Thanks.
People are learning to own their own voices. We hear a lot more about diverse voices in writing. And what do you think are ways that people are creating space for free expression of their ideas and their writing today?
I was just at an extraordinary conference in Albuquerque called something like Dreaming Big. I don't remember all the whole title, but it was really talking about culture and talking about all of these things in a time really of crisis. And one of the panels there was, which I I got to moderate, which was pretty scary, was about the new, sort of new forms. And I guess that some of the, you know, part of what I think is interesting is that the new forms are fed by the old. So we actually just saw the passing of someone named Sekou Sundiata, who was just an extraordinary poet and sort of beyond spoken word. He was the person whose poetry and music were absolutely one. He's just was astonishing, and he just died in New York. But the spoken word, which has of course so many traditional kinds of streams that have flowed in, whether it's the kind of African griot or Native American storytelling, or you know, storytelling from everywhere, and the music from everywhere that go into spoken word, and or the kind of, there's Puerto Rican plena y bomba that would give, you know, news, this sort of news, and you know, so some of it is the wonderful way that new forms are allowing the old forms from many different cultures to kind of fill it. I think that the internet is astonishing. I'm fascinated by the sort of what happens with self-publishing, because of course we were all smacked on the hand at some point and said, you can't do that, that's vanity, that's this, that's that. But there's some very powerful force saying, wait a minute, who, you know, what's the source of power, and who are the people in charge of saying these books will be made books and these will not be made books? And I think people are more and more saying, you know, I want to be heard, or I want to buy books from all kinds of people, not just the ones that are coming through some complicated, labyrinthine system of, you know, getting the right agent who has lunch with the right publisher. And, you know, and believe me, I would love the big and beautiful contracts, and no doubt I'm sure that I deserve them, but I think just all of the ways, I mean, print on demand and readings of all kinds, and the powerful sort of, you know, all of the ways of publication of being heard through things like this, through podcasts, through community radio stations in all kinds of places, I think this is wonderful, and I do think that the sort of shaking up of all the genres, the kind of filling of English with all the different kinds of Englishes. So we'll read someone like Zadie Smith, who's I don't even remember, but you know, all of the different, the way that the empire has come back into English, and the way that music has affected things, and the way that cultures keep crossing. So I'm in Minnesota right now, where, you know, you can walk into a restaurant and there's someone who's Hmong sitting near someone who's Somali, sitting near someone who's Swedish, sitting near someone who's Jamaican, and you go, this is good. This is this is the world. So I think that the world is ahead of, in a way, some of the tighter kinds of centers of power and centers of publishing, and there's just it's an exciting time in a way, but it certainly is a battle, as you know, as bookstores get bought up and newspapers get bought up. But it's the response from so many different kinds of people in so many different forms, and forms that are informed by both their own traditional cultures and the place where they are. Like when you hear someone who's a Hmong spoken word artist in Minneapolis, you go, wow, this is interesting. I mean, their parents came here. Their parents came in maybe the 70s or the 80s, and here they're doing this thing in English, and they're informed by their culture, but they're also informed by hip-hop and spoken word and all of that. So I just think it's a exciting, fascinating, interesting, vital kind of time.
I continually wonder if I'm living in the right century. Maybe I belong in the past one, but as far as writing itself, I think we absolutely live in the best time ever to be a writer, because there are so many ways to have your voice heard.
Yes.
And you mentioned the internet, and I did want to ask you a little bit about, I know that you now have been teaching some classes online or some workshops, and I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how that is, what the challenges of that are and how that's giving people voices.
Well, the bad thing is that what happened is that I am not yet doing that. I was going to be teaching Writing for Social Change online, and I was very excited about it because some things seemed to be happening that, for instance, people who took my workshops would then take the material and go to their writers' groups and be good to go for a year. but what happened is I started writing this book on all this material. I just knew it was time to do this and felt that I couldn't do that, sort of write up those kinds of things made for smaller bites, in a sense, for online at the same time I was writing this book. So I'm not doing that, but I am actually going to be probably teaching autobiography and autobiographical fiction, teaching that online with something called writers.com, which is one of the older online writing sort of classes, sites that's been going, I think, since 1995. So I'm going to be doing that. I've done a lot of work sort of long distance and online with people, both through classes I've taught in person that have kind of continued in informal, sorts of communications, and also connections, for instance, that someone found me in the Poets and Writers Directory, a man who lives in South Africa who had lived in Rwanda, and a wonderful man who has about 6 or 7 books that he's written in French, and he's trying to get translated and edited, and he kind of found me, and I was not, I did a little work with him, but was really unable to do all that he needed, but had been in touch with him for some time. And I guess I kind of like to suggest this, that one of the things that I would love to see, and I don't feel sort of up to starting it right now, but I would love to see the net used. For instance, I am in something called Women for Women International, and I, give my little bit of paltry money every month that helps women in post-war countries set up cooperatives or get health care or things like that. What I would love to see is a kind of Writer for Writer International, to have a way that someone like this man, Dicho, in South Africa, could be paired up with somebody who might be able to have, 4 hours a month in which she or he could help this person edit their stories that have been translated from French but still need editing, or something like that, to find a way that writers can be paired with people in other places, in other cultures, in other countries, and be of use or even mutually exchange, their work and kind of extend to each other a critique, a response that is, I think, in a way, brilliant, because it both looks at the work and also gives to each other a sense of how it might be understood in a culture that's considered to be a very different culture. So I'm hoping to do more online classes, but I have to get through this book. Got to write this thing. So.
Okay, and I did want to ask you about your book, too, that you're working on right now. And I know Victor said earlier that you're working on a novel centering on the experience of a Cambodian woman born of an African-American father at the moment of the bombing of Cambodia by U.S. forces. And
yes.
So could you maybe just give us a little bit of a hint about what the book is about and what made you come up with the idea for the book?
Yeah, this was one of those books that chose me as opposed to me choosing it. And Someone asked me a question, actually, a writer named Kathleen Spivak said, well, what, I had finished my first novel or a draft of it, and she said, well, for the next one, she said, what do you not want to write about? And I said, okay, I don't want to write about racism, the war in Southeast Asia, and prostitution. And then she said, okay, now write about it and write the best first paragraph you can imagine writing.
Wow.
Write the most sparkling, amazing, most fantastic language. I went, holy crap, pardon me. And somehow I was in this character. It was like one of those, you know, being John Malkovich things where you're just whooped into the head. I was in this character. I could not believe it, and she will not leave me alone. So it happened that way, and I understand in retrospect, you know, I've known there are some people who are very important to me who've had experiences, that one woman I know who was in the killing fields, and other friends who are vets in the war, and various people who are related to this. But this very particular character came to me, and part of her struggle is that she's brought eventually, she's also involved in prostitution as a very young person, as a child really, of 11 or 12, sort of right after Pol Pot. But she's kind of pulled away from things and brought by a relief worker into Boston. And they eventually, when she's of age, start a relationship, and they are together, and she becomes pregnant. And part of what she's trying to figure out is if she can have this child. And her at first she says, I can't have it. It's too mixed up. It's Cambodian and black and white. It's too mixed up. And she sort of believes that no one can even imagine this child. So if you can't imagine it, how can she bring it to the world? But I understand as I work with this character that part of the deeper question is, when someone experiences great evil, where does then that evil sit? Is there, how does that evil affect someone and their ability then to nurture someone else? And I think that's ultimately sort of a lot of what I'm going to be looking at in writing this book. I'm actually going to be doing a sort of a study of, this may sound wild, but of comparative demonology, to kind of look at different representations of evil, which my character gets a little fascinated by, because she just wants to understand what it is and where it's located. And that certainly has been my question since I can remember. And I do remember in Alice Walker's book, Possessing the Secret of Joy, one of the characters saying that, I think he said something like, the question that's always bothered him is, why is the child crying? And so I think that for all of us, some of the first questions that we have are some of the things that drive our writing, no matter how long we do it, how sophisticated it gets, how many different forms it takes. So I think there's early questions for me that are driving the writing of this novel.
Wow, that really gets at the heart of the human condition. I can't wait to see this for sure.
Thank you.
I just want to make sure that we hear about all of the websites that you're involved in. So can you give us a quick rundown of where we can learn more about what you do?
Great. My site, which of course is the most important, is just very cleverly named www.anyaochtenberg.com. So if I can spell it, it's it's ANYAACHTENBERG.com. And I will be in early 2008, I'll be teaching autobiography and autobiographical fiction, which I just love teaching, online through writers.com, a really great site, writers.com, many wonderful things there. And I'm also, I've done a lot of work for and always like to mention the International Women's Writing Guild, which is is www.iwwg.org. www.authorsaccess.org. So that's also a great site. And I'm trying to think if I there's the conference that I'm also involved in, which I think will be yearly. I'm not sure of the actual website, but if people Google Albuquerque Cultural Conference or Cultural Conference 2007, I think there's a website that is very close to that title. So those are the sites.
Great, and I want to thank you for being so generous with your time on behalf of Tyler and Irene, who couldn't join us, and myself. It's been a very inspirational show for me, and I'm going to go out on a limb here and invite you to refer people to me for my Reflections of History series, which really is meant to capture this sort of thing.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. And we'll email on that, yes?
Okay,
great. Thank you very much. I really appreciate this, and I really appreciate both you, Victor, and Tyler, and Irene for catching me in the first place. So thank you so much.
Thank you. You've been listening to another podcast edition of Authors Access, where authors get published and published authors get successful. We'll be back on the air September 27th, 2007, when our topic will be using social media to promote your book. And our guest who will be joining us is Deltina Hay. You can learn more about our guest on the Authors Access website, which is authorsaccess.com. Authors Access is a joint production of Reader Views Incorporated and Loving Healing Press.
For Reader Views, this is Tyler Tischler in Marquette, Michigan.
For Loving Healing Press, this is Victor Volkman in Ann Arbor, Michigan, wishing you all a good evening.